Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Break Through the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. I am the Director of Digital Services at Eastwick Communications. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today on this cool Bay Area day, or at least it's cool where I am, I have the pleasure of speaking with Tom Foremski of Silicon Valley Watcher. Thanks for being with us, Tom.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for having me.
Let's get right to it. We call the show Break Through the Noise because, at least in part, the show is about the ongoing discussion of where influence happens. How do you see influence happening today, broadly speaking?
Nothing much has changed. Influential people are the loudest people, the people that journalists and so on that are publishing a lot. Except that we have different media that we can publish in, and this fragmentation of media is quite interesting and also quite challenging.
Right, and we all, I think, know that a paradigm shift has happened when it comes to, for example, you know, the communication side of our business, working to help tech companies market themselves and communicate better with their audiences in a more transparent way. Eastwick saw this coming years ago before I was around and started doing social media efforts. I've sort of picked up the torch and ran with it since I've been with the company. But the thing that hasn't changed is still the need for companies to build awareness, create a preference for their products or services. What do you think the media's role in this new communications world order? I know I recently saw on your blog there was some discussion about, you know, old media versus new media. It's just all media, and I would completely agree with you. But how do you really see the media's role in this new world order?
Yeah, I think the traditional media clearly is still trying to find its way around. But I think it will eventually find its role, and I think that role will be a recreation of its traditional role of being an independent, third-party, vendor-neutral platform, which its role will be in helping to host the conversations and the discussions. Because in today's world, every company now, to some extent, is a media company. But with that comes a lot of responsibility because it's not just a three-month commitment. If you take on that role, it's a lifetime role, and I'm not sure if many companies appreciate that. Now, one way for it not to be a lifetime role in that way is to be able to have the media recreate itself in terms of becoming a platform for hosting these discussions and for hosting conversations. Because I don't believe that people want a social media relationship or a media relationship with a product, with a brand. It's just too many relationships to manage. However, they do like to have a media relationship with a media brand, say New York Times, if you will, or your local newspaper. And I feel that then becomes the place, the hub, if you will, where companies can interact with people.
And what's the role, do you think, of just taking one area and kind of getting your perspective on it, broadcast media? So television news, which we know has never been known for its great in-depth reporting, but with some newspapers going away and the beat structure that has always been so important to the news gathering process potentially fading, at least in some areas of the country where newspapers are disappearing. How do you see their role, or do you think it's sort of parallel?
Well, it seems the broadcast media typically takes its cues from, as you say, from the newspapers. And as their role diminishes, they'll find other sources of information online. They're not particularly good at going out and researching stories. I mean, some of the larger channels still do have news organizations that do that. But generally, they like to report on what other people have reported on. So kind of a blogger role in a way. So they can still continue doing that, I feel.
Yeah, I think there's a particular conundrum for them in that they have not, having come from the broadcast media world, you know, and seeing this opportunity, I'm not sure they see it as an opportunity. I think they're just afraid they're not going to know where to go to get their next story at the moment if, say, the Chronicle were to go away. But that's kind of a side note. And kind of where I'm going with that is I noticed that you have a pilot project going on that is video-based, and we know online video has been on the rise for quite some time. And how do you? I would love to hear more about your pilot project first, and then follow up more about the role of online media. Pardon?
Sure. So Fridays with Forensky, we produced a pilot show for that. And it consists, it's basically, it essentially follows me around in terms of reporting on conferences and interviewing people. And also it has a panel of people where we're discussing some of the topics of the day. And we're trying to go with television production values rather than web production values. And so we're looking for sponsors for that at the moment. Clearly, it's not the best timing given the economy, but also the disruption that is happening in the TV world. And I feel that there will still be a need for quality media, except right now we haven't figured out the value recovery mechanism that can can keep generating quality media. The business model for broadcast media is changing quickly as well, and you know, nobody yet has figured out how to make it pay online. So this is actually, I feel, one of the most important questions of our time at the moment is what will pay for quality media? What will pay for journalism? It's a question I've been asking for 4 or 5 years now since I left the Financial Times and realized that the economics of the new world would not be able to support the economics of the old world, and that there was going to be a tremendous problem coming up, and that's what we're seeing right now. It's the most important question of our time, I feel, because without quality media, we're not going to have quality information. And we're not going to have quality information where we can make good decisions. And there's a lot of important decisions we need to make today, not just on the economy, but on global warming and disease and education, healthcare. There's a lot of important stuff that we need to make important decisions on. If we don't have quality media, we're going to have what software engineers call garbage in, garbage out.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's very important, you know, to point out. And I think, you know, one of the things kind of along those lines that I, you know, I have some brilliant people that I work with, and one of them was reminding me that you've talked in the past a lot about Silicon Valley's tolerance for failure fueling kind of the culture of innovation. And so along those lines, you know, we were wondering together, do you think that the tolerance for failure will lessen given the recession, the competitive global markets? And if you do, how do you think the Silicon Valley will adapt?
The tolerance for failure is a quality of the culture here. And I think it's a quality of the culture that can't easily be exported to other areas around the globe. So even though innovation does exist all around the world, there's an aspect of innovation here that allows people to fail and fail repeatedly and then succeed. And that hasn't changed, and I don't see why it would change. And I constantly see companies moving their headquarters from around the country, from around the world, moving it to Silicon Valley. I think partly for that reason, because, there's several reasons, obviously, for being in Silicon Valley, but I do feel that culture of failure is really important. And it's something that you can't recreate. You can't just build a business park around a university and inject some capital. It takes more than that. And building that cultural infrastructure takes time. It can take decades and has taken decades here in Silicon Valley. So I see that as being a vital part of Silicon Valley and something that will continue.
And do you see that as being, this is more of a cultural question, but do you see this more as a Silicon Valley trait or as sort of American spirit type trait?
No, it's a Silicon Valley trait. I mean, it is part of the American culture, but I feel that the western part of the States is actually, you know, embodies that culture more so than, say, the East Coast, where, you know, it's, on the East Coast, it's not quite the same meritocracy as it is here. People here don't care which school you went to and so on. It's like, well, what have you done lately? While on the East Coast, it's more kind of old school in that way. So I do feel that it is specific to Silicon Valley, although, you know, we do see parts of that culture elsewhere in the U.S.
Yeah, I think there's something about Silicon Alley having tried to bring some of the Silicon Valley culture to New York. And having been a Columbia Journalism School graduate, I'm unfortunately have seen firsthand, you know, how that plays out. And I feel like that's more part of the way the media is structured and maybe professional relations are structured. But I really wonder if it affects sort of the everyday person who's trying to get good information about what technology to purchase, so making purchasing decisions or what new technologies to integrate into their lives, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's a separate issue when we talk about innovation and so on. We're talking about the future. You know, We're constantly reinventing the future here, and people want to make big changes in the world. While the East Coast culture and so on, it's more on, you know, revenues today, and you know, quite rightly so. You know, there's a lot from the East Coast culture that we could use here. But in terms of what technologies to use and which technologies to buy, I feel that's a separate question.
Yeah, it's sort of driven by the market overall. I think one question that I would be remiss without asking you about is, you know, circulation of print media in the UK. So The Economist and the Financial Times are always cited as publications that are doing well, their circulation is up, their ad revenues are either up or level. What do you make of that in terms of, you know, again, where influence is happening and the fact that at least those two media outlets, and there's obviously a few in the United States as well, but a few print publications that, you know, that you can say are making money and still retain influence, two of them at least are from the UK.
Yeah, and there are other examples, but I think you'll find that they're all fairly specialist examples. And, you know, also you've got to look at, are they making money online with their online operations? And I think you'll find that they're not really, even though they might, you know, move a few numbers around in the account in the county was to kind of make it look a little bit better. But it's more difficult to find publications that are doing well online. I think the Wall Street Journal seems to be doing well online. They have a hybrid model. They have an interesting model, actually. They put a lot of content behind their paywall. However, you can still access it because if you know the headline of the article you want, you can actually Google it, and Google will take you straight to it. So they open up their content to be cited by the search engine, but what they do is take away the navigation menu and then put that behind the paywall, which is an interesting hybrid model.
Absolutely. Now, Tom, you're echoing a little bit. I don't know if you're in a good spot or if it's just our phone connection, but just wanted
I'm
to
sorry.
Make you...
I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. So in terms of, I think that's an interesting point, you know, in terms of the hybridization, one of the things that obviously we're watching closely is how user-generated content is evolving, specifically Business Week Exchange being one of the places, but also actually a Columbia graduate friend of mine is heading up Wall Street Journal Discussions, which they're actually hoping becomes something kind of akin to Business Week Exchange. And, of course, you know, with the new leadership at the helm, there's more money to try things. And I think, you know, everybody knows that it's probably a good time to try things now, especially when people might have more time to be online if they're between jobs, et cetera. What do you make of those kinds of business content sharing, we'll broadly call that category, areas where a company could really influence what the user-generated content is that the magazine decides to use, for example, with Business Week's commitment to using a certain amount of user-generated content. And user is then defined as whomever's contributing, which could be a company.
Right, but I'm assuming it's going to be moderated content, right?
I think Business Week Exchange, yes, they will have, you know, the editorial staff will make decisions. But I think, you know, again, if something's a really interesting innovation, it could still be led from the company. I guess to your point, that makes even companies media companies, really.
Yeah, every company is a media company these days, whether they realize it or not. And in terms of user-generated content, I think the criteria is the content useful. When people send a letter to the editor, they don't publish every letter they get. They publish the interesting ones, the ones that take a discussion further on and so on. So I imagine even if the content comes from a self-interested party like a company, as long as it's providing something of value, then I don't see anything wrong with that.
So, you know, getting back to kind of the idea of influence in terms of what is swaying the everyday person in terms of the decisions they make about their life, where do you think technology buyers get their information, and what do you think sways their buying decisions these days?
I think it's the same influences as before. The peer group, the publications they read, and their own experiences with technology products.
And what do you think the role of? So, I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about reviews being a new kind of, in a sense, peer influence. Of course. I mean, I know that I personally use reviews all the time when, for example, I've been going through this drama of finding the right Bluetooth headset. So going through reviews and trying to figure out what, you know, is good information and what isn't is still tricky. But I find myself, you know, looking at user reviews on Amazon over, you know, a buyer's guide from CNET or some other, not to pick on CNET, but, you know, my concern would be that, you know, there could be corporate sponsorship involved. So I am more trusting of reviews. Newegg is another example of a technology site I can think of where reviews play a big role from the technology folks that I know. What do you make of that piece of the equation?
I think it's an important part, but even in those areas, you do see some kind of suspect reviews. There is a lot that is put in there by paid agents of companies. So you end up having to go for a tremendous amount of content and triangulate things and, you know, so making a decision on a $100 Bluetooth headset can take, you know, hours and hours probably. You might be better off just going to Best Buy and trying them out or something like that.
If only. but I think that, you know, one thing that I have to follow up on is the idea is that the community is to rate or kind of say yes or no about, at least in the case of Amazon, of helping police these reviews. And we have seen this in forums for a very long time. Do you not see that being effective, or do you think it just has yet to see its day come?
Well, I think, you know, everybody has an opinion on things, and generally when you have the community rating things, they all seem to kind of average out at an average rating, which doesn't really help much. For example, ratings on Yelp for restaurants. I know some of my favorite places get a really bad review because people don't know what to order in those places and so on. So I think people are less and less taking notice of user reviews in some cases. Again, it comes down to judging the content and seeing if it really relates to what you need or what you're looking for.
So I'd be remiss. People always want to know more about the people that I interview for the program. So, you know, kind of along those lines, which public sites or publications do you look to first for news?
I know it sounds funny, but I don't read too much online because I don't want to be influenced too much by other people's writing. You know, I like to... You know, I'm a journalist of the traditional kind. I like to go out to the source, go out, interview people, come back, write it up, maybe compare my experience with other people then read about things to see if I agree with other people's take. And if I don't, I have something original. If I do, then often I don't want to add to the noise out there. I don't like writing Me Too type stories. Traditions in a sense that newspapers used to be. It's like scoops or stories, interviews, stuff you can only get here. And, I don't read too much out there. I look at places like TechMeme and see what's kind of bubbling around in the zeitgeist.
And I
also look at Yahoo Finance. You know, I've been using Yahoo Finance for years, and I've got my page set up there to look at the stocks and what's moving markets and so on.
Interesting. So you're looking more kind of at what people are talking about than what's actually being written.
Yeah. But even now, I try and stay away from the echo chamber. When I look at tech memes, sometimes it seems all just one story, the iPhone or the Palm Pre and so on. So I'm always looking for something original to say, something that isn't being said already.
Do you ever find yourself from a journal. I've written a blog post I did early on when I started working at a communications company, saying, you know, I'll always consider myself a journalist. And you spend more than 10 years of your life doing one thing, I think it's hard to think of yourself in another way, but you can do other things. But I mean, do you ever find yourself, because this is always one of the checks that I used to do for myself, is finding yourself trying to find a contrarian point of view, but, you know, maybe that's not the most authentic point of view you really would have had?
Well, yeah, it's easy to be contrarian. I don't like to be contrarian just to be contrarian. But I do like to try and find new angles on stories that, you know, hundreds of people have already covered. For example, I like quarterly reports when companies state their revenues and so on, because often there's stories in those numbers that other people haven't seen. And even though we're all looking at the same content, we're all looking at the same source data, it's really fun to be able to find that story in those numbers that other people have missed. So I don't like to be contrarian for contrarian's sake, but I do like to try and find that original angle in on a story that people haven't considered before.
That's interesting. So, you know, getting back to, you know, kind of the idea of how media has changed. Print publications obviously still abound here and there. Just wondering if you do read any print publications. I know you've talked about how you interact with online media. Is it the same? Do you take that same view to print publications, or is there anything when you're flying here or there that you always pick up?
I like reading newspapers. I read any newspapers around. And I like some of the magazines as well, Business Week, Economist, and so on. I'm not an either-or kind of person. It's about and. I like reading print, and I like reading online and all the other things, too.
Is there anything in particular, I don't know if because my husband's English, but I think it's the Mail on Monday or Mail on, I can't remember. Anyway, there's a sports supplement that he claims no matter how much he, you know, combs the BBC and all the other websites that he uses, Supersport in South Africa, etc., he's still always, when somebody's going to the UK, he always asks them to bring that back. That's the only thing he wants. He doesn't want his favorite snack. He doesn't want, it's the way they, for him, and I've, you know, because I sort of study this as a hobby, I've specifically asked him a lot of questions about what it is, but it's part of it is the way they report, part of it's how they put the information together, so kind of a little bit of the packaging. Is there anything like that for you, whether it's online, offline, video, any kinds of media where you just go, you know, I just find myself gravitating back to that because of the way that it's done?
I'm not sure if I have that particularly, but yeah, I do enjoy media that has a personality, and that, I enjoy reading The Chronicle, for example, because I know where things are, or at least I did. There's a lot of comfort and familiarity in that way, in enjoying the personalities of the columnists and so on. So once a publication, whether it's online or offline, creates that relationship with a reader, then that's gold, because you become part of their daily routine or their habit. And it's really difficult to dislodge that kind of audience
Tom, are you still with us?
Oh,
hello?
Yeah,
you just bottomed out for a second. So how can you tell? I assume you're shooting for, obviously, the gold standard in terms of relationships to readers or users, however you define them for your publication being online. You know, do you have people write into you, or is it about analytics and how many people are watching your site? And how are you kind of broadly defining success or connection with readers in the way that we're kind of talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the metrics of the business change all the time, and these days there's a swing towards the real-time web with Twitter and so on, and Facebook and so on. So, and the thing about the real-time web is like it's there when you're there, but it's not when you're not. So, it seems you know the format of media is changing as well because of that, and so measuring success. That metric is changing all the time, and right now, I'm not quite sure what it is. But my main metric is to please one person, and that's myself. Because I figure you can't please everybody, but if I can please myself, if what I do interests me, then at least it makes it easier for me to interest other people in what I'm doing. If I'm not interested in what I'm doing, then that's going to be really difficult to interest other people. So at the end of the day, if I'm excited and interested in the stories that I'm writing about and the people I'm speaking with, then it seems to make the rest much easier, and it's much easier for other people to also be interested in that content.
Completely true. It's one of the things I love about your writing is I can always kind of feel or sense your kind of take on things as being, you know, I guess it's part of that original voice that you've built for yourself. But I have to come back to you and ask, there's the sense of success for yourself in terms of the analytics you may or may not look at, and then, of course, pleasing yourself, and I'm sure you have a very high standard. But what, you know, and you're talking about, you know, you mentioned earlier, you know, getting sponsors to build on your pilot project in this economy to provide quality media. What kind of metrics are you kind of, do you feel you may be held to, or that in the industry at large we're looking towards, because I have a sense that we might not be looking at the right things.
Yeah, that is true. You know, we're still, I think it was Lenin that said that we still have the corpse of the old world in the new world when he was talking about the revolution. But still, people want to buy numbers, so they want to buy large numbers. So they want to buy, say, a site with, you know, I don't know, a million unique views or a million readers. Yeah, really, they just want to target, say, maybe 10,000 people in that readership that are important to them. Now, there might be a site which just has 10,000 of those unique readers that a company wants, but it's difficult to justify that kind of buy because, you know, people's bosses and so on, they look at numbers. And so we're still dealing with that world of large numbers. It was interesting, Nick Denton, publisher of Gawker Media, quoted him recently saying, the dream of micro-publishing is dead. You know, we used to think that the magic of advertising would find the right content and so on. But at Gawker, we're now 12 or 13 million readers a month, and we think we're reaching that point of scale, you know, of like 15 million a month that will enable us to get the big advertisers and so on. So there, again, you know, people still looking at that large number, that big number, rather than looking at, well, it's not the number of eyeballs, it's actually who the eyeballs belong to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I see that as a fantastic arbitrage opportunity there, that the ad agencies that do understand that, or the companies that do understand that, will be able to dramatically lower their marketing costs and so on. But it's not happening yet, and there's still that desire for the large numbers. And it's also devaluing the more targeted sites as well, because if it's a numbers issue, then it's difficult for them to compete.
Right. Well, I think that what's interesting is we recently, and I, you know, in helping lead the charge to kind of qualify how we determine influence, either in relationships for the companies that we represent or whatever, my struggle when I got there was that a lot of things were being done manually. And I wanted to get into this sort of the scientific part, technology part, you know, looking at Radian 6 as one of the examples, I see that as being very quantitative, still kind of with that model. But we ended up going and partnering with a company that was very qualitative, where I could actually get down to the discussion level and actually look at posts, so that if I wanted to go deep, it allowed me to really, really figure out what people were saying at a very granular level, and how you could potentially influence a conversation or explain to somebody, you know, or, you know, pop it up a level and know that the search algorithms that are in place are there because of a qualitative means, not necessarily a quantitative means, because site traffic is not necessarily a guarantee at all that you're going to get something of quality. So I can't agree with you more. I think that's, you know, and it's also one of the sad things about online video, in that I think people put a lot of money and emphasis behind it, and then CPMs are down, and, you know, everyone's going, well, is video really the way? And they look at YouTube not making money and thinking that, you know, maybe that's not the way to go. But I have a sense that we're just not looking at it the right way, and the person that does is going to crack a huge nut. So we're at about the midpoint, and I just want to welcome those of you that are just joining us to Break Through the Noise. I'm speaking with Tom Forensky of Silicon Valley Watcher. One thing I wanted to ask you about was the role of analysts today. How do you see that? We've seen people like Charlene Lee doing something a little bit different, leaving Forrester Research, and I think it's kind of interesting to chat with her about where her particular career has gone. But in general, what's your make of the influence that analysts wield today versus 10 years ago?
I'm not sure. I mean, what Charlene Lee has done is a traditional track that other analysts have done. And, also her colleague, Jeremiah Ouyang, Forrester, he's a good example of an analyst that is using the new media to build their brand and also build their business. Generally, the analysts, when I was working at the Financial Times, for example, we didn't use them too much because, they're paid for by companies, and it's difficult to figure out who's paying them for what. You see them quoted in press releases, so clearly they were paid for that service. They do have influence within companies because large corporations do contract with them for their analysis. But in terms of the media, I don't see them quoted too much these days. So I think their influence in that realm seems to have waned a little.
So, I mean, it sounds like you were never really a huge fan of using analysts as a way to look at trends.
No, because, in some publications, you weren't allowed to state what you felt was the story. In the Financial Times, our line was, well, we know just as much as the analysts often about this story, and phoning somebody up just to get them to say what you wanted to say didn't seem to make sense. And that's what happens. I get called by reporters for my analysis on various things, and I'm happy to help out. But I know analysts that are generally famous for calling for a quote about anything just because your editor said you had to have an analyst quote in the story. So that doesn't really add much value if you have that kind of setup.
But do you think, analysts were kind of new to me when I started at Eastwick in August of last year, and I've, in that time, felt like I've seen this huge shift, almost to the folks like Jeremiah and Charlene who are more transparent. And more about the larger trend, let's say, than necessarily, because they have their own brand, they can kind of, come to an event, let's say, and moderate it, and they can provide perspective based on, their big history of researching for a bunch of different people. And I almost find that more interesting, and I feel like maybe that's, I don't know. I really wonder, especially when I read analyst tweets, and I see them kind of, they just seem to be in this strange place, and I kind of wonder what the evolution will be for that role.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Charlene and Jeremiah, I think that they're a new breed of analysts. But traditionally, the analysts, they're so busy talking to their own clients and so on, and they're kind of miserly with their insight, or maybe if you were unkind, you might say they really didn't have that much insight in the first place. One thing I've noticed about the online world is there seems to be a basic rule is to, give away a lot of value if you can, because that way also people feel that you have still more value in your back pocket somewhere.
Absolutely.
So it's and also it creates room to create more value. So I'm always encouraging people not to be miserly about their insights and ideas because you should give away as much as possible. Really, it creates room for more.
And I have to say, you were incredibly lovely about setting up this very interview over Twitter. So, you're incredibly accessible, and we thank you for that because I think that's it's a rare thing, and it's funny because there are social media strategists who have my role at other places that I communicate with by phone or email without a problem, and sometimes when I direct message them on Twitter, I don't hear back from them right away. When that seems to be one of the rules of the road that we teach our clients is if someone direct messages you, it's something akin to a text message. You need to respond to it a little quicker. But
yeah. I'm really bad on email though. I
noticed, but I wasn't going to mention that. I'll let you talk to email.
No, I wish I was better, but if I go to my inbox, I can lose 4 or 5 hours of not having done much. So
I feel you on that.
So Twitter seems a lot less stressful to me than my inbox, to be honest.
And I think you're not alone, actually. A number of CEOs that we talk to, again, that lovely restraint of 140 characters can be so appealing to people that aren't used to writing or that can write well but only in short gasps. So, you know, actually, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, and I think it's people are abandoning their blogs, too, now, because they're spending time on Twitter and they prefer that format. But
Absolutely. Again,
it's a kind of a fleeting existence in a way, Twitter.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, this kind of touches on something that, you know, that one of my colleagues pointed out as a question that I think is a really good one, from my point of view anyway. You know, what do you think are some of the top characteristics that you think standout CEOs will need to possess in the continually changing tech landscape? Are they different than they were 5 years ago? What is a good CEO?
Oh, it's the same. It's the same. CEO should, it should stand for Chief Excitement Officer. You know, you're constantly interacting with your customers, investors, and generally CEOs are pretty good at that. But they shouldn't be expected to sit down and write a blog post, for example, or tweet too much and so on. You can have people around them to help them do that or even, say, interview them in this kind of format. But, you know, so CEOs are pretty good at that. It's when people try and shoehorn them into different roles, I think, is when the trouble happens.
So who do you see as being really good at having adapted to, not necessarily adapted, somebody who's really good these days about communicating with their customers, even prospects, as sort of, as you say, the chief excitement officer?
You know, I don't know, because in a way I'm not the target market. So I'm sure there's a lot of that happening out there, but because I'm not really a customer of, say, Sun or IBM, you know, I don't get to see that. So I don't really know who's really good at that.
So, I mean, do you think that there's, you know, I'm very adamant about the difference between strategy and tools, but do you think that there are any, so looking from a more tactical point of view, tools that CEOs need to know how to use? So, you know, I think you made a good point with not every CEO needs, I mean, some CEOs take to Twittering. Some of them don't need to be doing that. They need to be on a podcast or just being, you know, Forbes.com does a great interview series, and we've had a couple of our CEOs there. And they do a great job, you know. I mean, that's their job in a sense, is to talk up the company. But do you see there being a particular tool set that they at least should be aware of? One thing. What about the – so one area I meant to mention was the – you know, I think that we're going to see – in fact, over the course of the week on my journalism school listserv for new media, one of the big questions was, you know, obviously there's a lot of – folks that go to journalism school and look down on Twitter as a news source. And I think, you know, you can agree with that, you know, in large part. However, I made, you know, and maybe I was just being contrarian, but I made the point that we have yet to see mobile rise as it has in other, or as much as it has in other countries, and it will. So does the value of writing short or learning how to be more powerful in 140 characters, 160 if you're talking about text messages, is that still a transferable skill that journalists need to be able to grasp?
Oh, yeah. Totally. I mean, look at headlines.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you've got less than 140 characters there. You know, so you can look at Twitter as a headline and a link to a story. I mean, that's what a lot of my tweets are. But the problem is that, unfortunately, there's a lot of journalism professors that haven't been anywhere near a newsroom in 20, 30 years. And so I wonder what kind of skills people are being taught these days, or many useful skills. Generally, you know, I found that people who have been to journalism school have been taught the proper way of writing, say, but it doesn't really transfer that well into the real world out there. And the only way you can learn is by being in the real world, by being part of the media world. You're not going to understand what Twitter is about unless you're part of Twitter, you're in it. You can read all you want about it, but you won't get it unless you're in it.
I completely agree with you. I mean, my background was 7 years of real-world experience and then decided that I wanted to get my master's degree and in journalism. So I had one of my professors, had been, her entire career was with Nightline, and that was her complete perspective on broadcast when I had worked in, before, up to that point, mostly in local news, before I went to network. And it's a completely different animal. And so I was trying to, I found a lot of, students coming to me, and I don't mean this in a sort of self-righteous way, but, ask me what's it like in a newsroom. And I always tell people that the best journalism school I went to was my first job. In a tiny market where I had to learn everything. I know how to tune in a satellite remote. I know how to do, I know how to edit on 3/4 video, which people don't even use anymore and have no idea what I'm talking about. But I think the key is obviously being nimble. I think that's and adapting to the time. Same thing with companies, being able to be nimble and adapt with the times. And to a certain extent, I think CEOs play that role from a top-down position, right? If they don't look like they're adapting, at least look like they're adapting, does that not impact the staff that maybe have more of a role in communicating with the media or others about their product or brand?
Well, I'm kind of puzzled why you keep concentrating on CEOs in this respect, because the communications team of a company, that I feel that CEO takes part in that, but the CEO doesn't have to be the spear, the head of the spear on that. We used to talk about evangelists, and now that's coming back to a certain extent, and that kind of role is important, but it doesn't have to be done by the CEO. The CEO has to interact with a lot of different constituencies.
Absolutely. I think I'm talking from a sign-off perspective, and what we find with the companies we work with, either it's the small startups where the CEO really is doing a lot more than they used to because of the way the economy is, or just the way the cookies crumbled. Or that there's just this level of sign-off that needs to occur, or this feeling that sign-off has occurred. Does that make sense?
Right.
Because it's a search for ROI, really. I think that's part of the fuel.
Well, I think this this sign-off issue, by the time you sign off on something, it's probably too late, especially these days with the real-time nature of the web and so on. So I think the CEO can do something important in terms of empowering his team of, stating the parameters of their interactions and so on, so that they can be more real-time in their communications. I think there's an important role that CEOs can play there, definitely. Mm. But in terms of...
Sorry,
I just
ahead.
Wanted to come back a little bit to journalism students and so on. It's something I've been writing back for a while, is that there's a real need for a media engineer. And it's in a similar sense of a software engineer. Journalists... can barely type, they certainly can't spell very well, but they can tell stories well. But I know many journalists, or some journalists, who don't even know how to upload an image to their web server. I feel that Janice should learn a little bit about these media technologies that we have now. Things like HTML, how a web page is put together, CSS, how that determines the format of content. They don't have to be experts at it, but they should know how things work and the basics of this stuff, because you know it is increasingly an online world, and they need the skills to be able to prosper in that online world, and those are some of the skills that they need these days.
Just one last thought. I can't help but notice how many people I know in the business world are just on and on about the IdeaCast, the podcast that Harvard Business School does, and obviously their publishing unit has a lot of really interesting, email and other output, website content, RSS, that is incredibly. They really seem to have almost targeted the consumer market. So they've become, another publication. Do you see more universities like Stanford potentially having a role that way through their business schools or other schools in their domain?
Yes, definitely. I mean, they should. If you've got a bunch of experts in their fields, then you should publish that as widely as possible, and the internet allows you to do that. And also, the promise of distance learning, for example, we still haven't gotten anywhere close to that. These schools have great lecturers. Why can't they webcast the lectures, for example? I'm still waiting for the global university, if you will, to happen, because we have the technologies available. We just haven't had the will, I guess.
I mean, I have an example recently where I had as we're putting on an event with, four social media clubs later this month. What I found a little troubling was that a very high-profile professor, instead of just politely declining, told me that their speaking fee was X amount of dollars, and it was quite a lot. And being that we are trying to help a nonprofit organization and others that are interested in learning about social media that maybe feel distanced from it or whatever the case may be, the point is it's a nonprofit, and the idea is to help educate. Was concerned about gating their information with fees that are a bit exorbitant was a little strange to me, and I hope we don't see too much of that filter in, because as I agree with you completely, I think universities can be a very, very valuable place for us to turn to, and I think we will see more with distance learning. I think we have to.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
The world is just becoming, too global, and we're so connected all over the world that most of us have these stories of family members all over the world. I have that. I'm sure you do. And that alone fuels the interest and desire to seek out other kinds of information. But on that note, I'm going to let you go and get on with your day. I thank you so much for being open to speaking with us. I feel like
did I tell you about my speaking fee?
Pardon? Oh, no, you can't tell me about a speaking fee now. It's too late. That's an upfront question. But we thank you for your time, and we'll let you go so you can get on with the business of telling us, providing information to us from your unique perspective. Again, that's Tom Foremski from Silicon Valley Watcher. And I want to thank the audience for tuning in to Break Through the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Next week, our guest is Chris Huer of Social Media Club, among many other things. That's 1 week from today at 12 noon. As always, you can keep up with the latest on this show and Eastwick in general at blogs.eastwick.com. Have a great weekend.